originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, wherever you may be. Trainer Talk is on the air. Tonight's broadcast, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to. This is Jude Feld, and I'm absolutely delighted to spend the next hour with you and our special guest. Tonight's trainer was born in Albany, New York, and cut his teeth on racing at Saratoga. He has won 340 races in his career, many of them with horses you will certainly recognize, like Battle One, Strength and Honor, Sabalina, Free for Internet, and Air Bueno. Along the way, he has amassed over $10 million in purse earnings. Our guest is tremendously respected by his peers and an outspoken advocate for racehorses everywhere. Welcome to Trainer Talk, Chuck Simon.
Thank you.
How's it going?
It's going pretty good.
Cool. Well,
I had some of that $10 million left.
Yeah, that's the complaint of many trainers on this show, regardless of how many millions it is that they've earned in purse, is it goes fast, doesn't it?
It sure does.
It's amazing.
It sure does.
Well, you were on Trainer Talk in 2013, back when it was only a half hour per trainer show. And that night, you revealed that you and your brother made money at Saratoga and Monmouth as stupers. Talk about that. You got any of that money left?
Yeah. I'm surprised the IRS hasn't come after. As a matter of fact, I think I made more money as a stupor than I did as a trainer, honestly. But, you know, it used to be a little more fun because the tickets were a different color. I guess I'm showing my age. But, you know, the different money designations were different colors. I think $20 was green and $50 was red and $5 was blue and black was the hundreds, so we didn't see those that often. But it was a little different. Now, you know, now the tote systems all use the same boring tickets.
Yeah, the gray with the other gray.
Yeah,
I was noticing
when
I bet
they usually have the losers on. I don't have any winners.
I was noticing when I left Churchill Downs on Kentucky Derby Day that there were people with bags and bags of tickets. And I know, you know, nowadays you can take them to a machine and run them through. I don't know how many you'd have to – you can't bring your whole bag of tickets back in. But I was kind of wondering how many overserved Mint Julep customers threw tickets away, and I bet it's a considerable amount of money.
Yeah, it's probably like a national holiday for Stupers Derby Day because between people that aren't familiar with what they actually bet and mint juleps and you know, the $12 beers or whatever they're serving, people seem to probably throw away more more winning tickets as losers than any other day, I would imagine.
Yeah, you would have to think so, and I don't know how many, you know, thousands of dollars that were in those big plastic bags, but had to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, the ones that were lined up that I saw on my way out of the track. Kind of crazy. You know, it was interesting to me, but not unprecedented, that you started your career in horse racing in the harness business. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, growing up in Saratoga, the harness track was open, you know, most of the year, whereas the thoroughbreds at that time, when I was young, there wasn't even off-season training. It was just the 4 weeks of the meet, and they would open the backside a few days before the meet, and it would close a few days after. So there really wasn't that much time there. But I was always big. You know, I was a big kid, so I could pass for older, and I started sneaking in the the maintenance gate at the harness track when I was 14 and 15, and got various odd jobs here and there. It just was more accessible because there just wasn't, the thoroughbreds. They just weren't training there very often. In the beginning of summer, the harness was the only game in town. So I started off there, and actually, after I graduated from University of Arizona, I worked as assistant racing secretary at Yonkers for a couple years, which was interesting. I mean, I made a lot of friends and gained a lot of insight into how the race cards are made and kind of got the point of view from the racing secretary's side, which a lot of trainers don't really have. It's a tough position. The racing secretary's got a tough job because they're in between management, which has one goal, and horsemen, which have another goal. And, they need both. They obviously have to keep their bosses happy, but by the same token, they also have to not piss off the horsemen to the extent where they won't help them when they need it. So it's a stressful job, and I did it for 2 years, and that was about enough for me. I really missed the backside, so I decided I was gonna take my chance on the backside as a trainer. So
did you ever have a desire to train harness horses?
I actually did train a harness horse here or there. I wasn't very good at it, so. It's a totally different concept. They think that, we're just guys with stopwatches and cups of coffee standing at the rail.
My ex-wife thought that.
A harness horseman. the harness guys, they actually, do a lot of their own training, and some of them actually shoe the horses. It's a little more hands-on for them, but obviously, people like you and I would have a hard time galloping. So it's just a different way of doing things. And standardbreds are so much tougher than our horses. God, they're just a different breed. It's so funny that I had a veterinary friend of mine that has worked primarily with standardbreds, and he's starting to dabble a little bit in thoroughbreds, as the harness game is struggling worse than ours. It's taken him a while to understand that the difference between lameness in a standardbred and lameness in a thoroughbred are completely different. That a thoroughbred will be lame over almost anything, where a standardbred, to get them actually lame, they've got to about have a broken bone. I mean, they're just tough, tough animals. And, they're running 40 times a year, some of them, and 2, 3, 4 times a month, where if you try to do that with our horses, they would, they'd lay down in a stall and not get up.
Yeah, they would absolutely crumble. What's the basic difference between a harness racing office and a thoroughbred racing office?
Well, the one thing the harness have is it's a little easier for them is that they don't have different distances or surfaces. They just have primarily the same distance and obviously the same surface. Where for a thoroughbred racing office, you have grass races, you have sprint races, you have distance races. So you have so many more subcategories. And over there, they race. They'll race 2-year-olds against older horses. It's kind of fillies against colts is not something that's unusual. So they've got it a little bit easier in that they've got a lot more latitude, and harness racing secretaries have a lot more power to move horses within the card for that day. If you enter the 7th race, which might be a non-winners of 10,000 last 5 starts, they can move you to a different spot. They have that they're allowed to do that, which in thoroughbreds would make people very unhappy. You entered in one spot and they moved you to another spot. It's just a little bit different because the other thing is the horses race so much more than our horses. We're coming back in a week is the norm. We're here coming back in a week is done for the most part on a irregular basis. Not just people just don't run back that quick.
Yeah, that's for sure. Like, if you run a horse back in 6 days, people start wondering what's wrong with you. If you tuned in late, this is Trainer Talk, and we're talking with trainer Chuck Simon on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You know, we had we've done over 100 shows, Trainer Talk shows, and your litany of trainers that you work for is unprecedented. It's better than probably anybody we've ever had on this show. Why don't we talk about that a little bit? I know you started out with George Weaver and Jeff Lucas under the Dwayne Lucas banner. How was that experience?
Actually, I worked for kids when I was a kid at up in Saratoga for trainers that probably no one will ever heard of. I can't even really remember their names, but working for Lucas was the first job I got when I left Yonkers, when I no longer wanted to be a racing secretary, and it was really eye opening for me, and I learned a lot. Jeff was kind of a maybe a standoffish guy if you didn't really know him, but once you got to know him, he was very generous with me, and I asked a lot of questions, and he would sometimes sigh when he answered them, but he was very good. George Weaver was the foreman, and Todd was the assistant at the time, but he wasn't there. He was on the road a lot when I was working there. But I learned a great deal about organization, how to run a big barn, how to run a big outfit, having to make sure that things were in order and that everything was done on a timely basis. And it was a very, very well run barn. It was the first time I'd worked for an operation that worked in that manner, where everything sets, the 7:30 set went out at 7:30, not at 7:25, not at 7:35. And it was a kind of a tough downtime at that time for the Lucas stable. We had a couple good horses, I remember. We had Light and Dance Floor, but it wasn't the typical powerful Lucas stable that it had been the previous few years. But it was a good experience for me, and I do thank Jeff and Wayne obviously for giving me an opportunity.
Well, I knew Jeff when he was assistant for Wayne at Santa Anita, but it wasn't until after he had his accident that I really got to know him well, and we used to play golf together occasionally, and I found him at that time to be just a delightful guy with a tremendous sense of humor, and he took all of his injuries and situation with a certain lightness that was definitely refreshing, and I think about him often. He was a really good guy.
He was an excellent trainer. I mean, he noticed everything, and we had I think 50 some horses there at Belmont, and he knew every single horse by right off the bat. I mean, it wasn't like he had to even think about it. But I respected his horsemanship a lot, and the fact is that he beat us all to the barn in the morning, and he was always the last one to leave. So he put the time in, and it was a terrible tragedy, obviously, what happened to him. And you never know exactly what fate becomes of anyone or anything, but it's hard to imagine that he wouldn't have been a really top trainer on his own right had he chose to make that move.
Yeah, a very talented guy, and virtually every trainer that we've had on the show that worked for Jeff credits him with their success. He was evidently a fantastic teacher. You mentioned in the previous show working for Tom Skiffington, who was a really great guy, and good friends with Eddie Gregson, who I was close to on the West Coast. And I'll never forget meeting Tom Skiffington with Eddie, and we just spent the whole morning laughing and joking out on the apron at Santa Anita. Talk about working for Tom.
Working for Tom. Tom was really the first assistance job that I had. In between Lucas and Skiffington, I worked for Peter Ferriola at Aqueduct, who was the top dog at that point in the wintertime. He had a big outfit, and it was kind of ironic that as organized as Lucas was, Peter's was disorganized. I mean, it was kind of a little bit of organized chaos. But Tommy gave me an opportunity to actually be an assistant trainer of real life, you know, assistant trainer, not just kind of a glorified foreman. And Tommy was an excellent horseman, and he was a very, very good rider. At the by the time I worked for him, he didn't get on very many. Mostly, he just he would get on a horse to try to embarrass Henry Cochran, who was the other assistant at the time. Henry'd get off of a horse that was tough, and Tommy would, you know, just jump off, throw a cigar down, and I'll show you how to gallop this horse, and gallop the horse around two fingers. But he's very, very detail oriented, and very, you know, Tommy was demanding. I mean, things had to look perfect. He wanted the horses to be rubbed a certain way. He wanted the horses to be done up a certain way. He wanted everything a certain way, and it had to be that way, which was you know, a good thing, though at the time, you know, a little bit difficult sometimes. And we had about 40 horses at Belmont one day, and we had two round pens. And he said to me, "Chuck, I want every horse to be turned out before they train." And I was like, "How long do you want them turned out?" "At least 15 minutes each." So I'm starting to do the math, you know. I'm like, "Damn, we have to start turning horses out like 2 o'clock in the morning." He says, "I don't care how you do it. Just get it done." I was like, "Okay." So I told the night watchman, you know, starting 2:30, just start putting these horses out, you know. And we did it for, it wasn't that long, but I still don't know if he actually just wanted to test me to see if I was capable of doing it, or just he really wanted it done. But Tommy was a very, very good horseman, and it was funny when I worked for him, and obviously prior to that, they used to call him Scratchington, because he would handicap the race, and if his horse was 5-2 or greater, he didn't want to run. He wanted to run the favorite all the time. And I remember the first time that he went on vacation, we were at Gulfstream, and he went on either a cruise, he went to Jamaica or something for a week, where he was kind of out of touch, because this was the Stone Ages before cell phones and computers and stuff. So we only had one horse to race that during the time frame where he wasn't going to be there, and it was a horse that had come from Europe and was owned by a lady in England. And he said, "If it comes off the turf, under no circumstances are you to run this horse. I don't care what the stewards, the racing office tells you, do not run the horse." So, lo and behold, morning of the race, it's pouring rain. Of course, I've never even scratched a horse, so I camp out over at the steward's office, because I want to be there and be the first one to scratch, because this is, you know, Tom's going to have my hide if I don't get this horse scratched. So they came in, and Walter Blum was the steward, and I said, "Mr. Blum, you know, Chuck Simon, I work for Tom Skiffington, and, you know, the race is, it sounds like it's going to be off the turf, and, you know, we'd like to put a scratch in." So he kind of grumbled and said, "All right, you know, fine." So I said, "All right, great." So I ran back to the barn, and 9 o'clock time he called. I said, "Yep, we scratched the horse, you know, it's off the turf, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "All right, call the bloodstock agent and call the owner and let him know, and, you know, the numbers are all here, and I'll call you tomorrow." So, all right, great. So I call up the people, tell the horse is scratched, everything's fine. About 9:15, I hear a page over the loudspeaker. "Tom Skiffington's assistant, call the stewards immediately." So I'm like, uh-oh, that doesn't sound good. So I called over there, and I guess everybody else wanted to scratch too. And they said, "Well, Tommy scratches all the time, so we're unscratching you." And I was like, "Oh my God, you can't unscratch me." And I already told them, and I called the people in England, and I'm going to lose my job if you do this. You know, if you make me run, he's going to probably fire me. And I said, "I got to be honest, I don't think I'm going to bring the horse up. So I don't know what the fine for that is, but it's got to be better than losing my job." So he got his hand over the phone, and I heard some grumbling. And then I go, "Oh, you're scratched." And hung up. And I was like, "Oh, thank God." I mean, I don't know if I ever even told him that they tried to unscratch us, but... I saw him recently, I guess about 2-3 months ago. He's got a barn in Wellington. He leases out to show horses. He does, he's kind of in the show horse world now. So, he seems happy. He's not at riding weight anymore, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I saw him about a year ago at Gulfstream. Maybe it was a little longer than that, right before the chief died. And I talked to him for a few minutes. He's a great guy. Always perpetual tan. Always looks like he just stepped out of the Tommy Bahama magazine, you know, collar turned up and all that stuff. It's just fantastic. Well, you also worked for Hall of Fame trainer Nick Zito. That must have been an interesting experience.
It was. Nick and I had been friends for a long time. We used to shoot hoops, shoot baskets. Nick used to fancy himself a pretty decent player. He had a pretty good shot. And, you know, we were always friendly. And the opportunity came up to work for him one spring. And this was when he was at the height of his powers. We had Gopher Gin and Mr. Greeley and all kinds of good horses. And I worked for him for about 3-4 months. I spent some time at Gulfstream, Keeneland, back at Belmont. And honestly, it was great learning experience. You know, again, doing things a little bit differently than the people who I'd worked for before. And, you go from Skiffington's barn where you're primarily working with turf horses to Nick's barn where turf horses were almost non-existent. So it was like a 180-degree difference in the type of horses that we had. But it was a good experience, and I would have stayed, but a job, an opportunity came up with Mr. Jerkins that just didn't happen very often. There was the people didn't leave those jobs, and one of the assistants for him got himself in some trouble, and he wasn't going to be back for a while, and I kind of jumped at the opportunity. So it was just sometimes being in the right place at the right time, more a matter of luck than anything. But I was able to secure a job working for Mr. Jerkins, and that was really kind of the culmination of my experience on the track. Was working for him was way different than everyone else. But I think like everyone has their own training style. You know, you work for a guy, you pick up things, and I was able to pick up something from everyone, and try to incorporate that into your own way of doing things, which I think, over the years, maybe I do things a little differently than I used to. Sometimes it's just a matter of circumstance based upon where you're at, based upon the horses you have. You can't train them like mile and a half turf horses if they want to go 5/8 in the dirt, and vice versa. But, working for Jerkins was such an eye-opening thing. The one thing that always struck me was that he took these angles and he looked at things in a different prism than everyone else did. He looked at so many, he considered so many things that you didn't think of. And once he said it, then you started to say, well, man, that's so obvious. Why hadn't I thought about that? And I think that was one of the great things that he was able to do as a trainer, as a horseman. He was able to kind of look at things in a little different way than the way everybody else does. And I think that's one of the reasons he was able to get so much out of his horses. And he used to preach to us all the time. And he used to say, we got to work harder than Shug, and we got to work harder than Mott, because those guys got better horses than us. And if we don't put them in ice, and we don't do this, and we don't graze them, and we don't give them dandelions, and we don't do this, we're never going to win any races. Yeah. So he'd get us all paranoid, and we'd be fired up, we'd be putting them in ice, we'd be out there turning them out and schooling them and doing all these things. And, right to the end, he was working 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And it was an honor to work for him. And I've said this before, he was a far, far better person than he was a horse trainer. And he was a great, great horse trainer. But he helped so many people. The list of people he helped would be far longer than the list of stakes he won. When he won hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stakes. But from the smallest, smallest hot walker up to, guys like Jack Dreyfus, he He did everything in his power to help everyone he came in contact with, and you just can't say that about many people.
Yeah, no, he helped me the first time I met him. Richard Mandel and I had a Phillies in the Orchid Handicap, and we shipped into his barn. Richard got it all set up for us, and I was the first one to arrive with the horses, and he couldn't have been any nicer to me. It was like I was his long-lost friend. You know, Jude, what do you need? How can I help you? Whatever you need, you just ask my boys. They'll take care of everything for you. I mean, it was outstanding. And something you said on the show the last time you were on, you said, when I went to work for Alan Jerkins, I thought I knew a lot about horses. After 3 days, I found out I knew nothing. And I thought that was a classic quote. Just an amazing tinkerer and a guy that was always adjusting, changing equipment. It was like that's all he ever thought about was how can I make this horse better?
That's so true, and that quote is actually was the way I felt. I remember thinking, man, I thought I knew a lot. I don't know anything, you know. You work for all these guys and these Hall of Fame trainers, and you know they train differently, but they looked at things, they approached things the same. Alan approached things differently. I mean, he would do things with horses that you would just, you would say, I mean, even now I say to myself, I could never do that. I don't have the balls to try that. We had a horse named Foyle, and he ponied her 15 days. He worked her once, ponied her 15 more days, and ran her in a grade two. she'd been running allowance races, and, you know, she went off and she ran great. She didn't win, but she hit the board, but she was kind of a real frail, light horse, and I just don't know that many people who have the confidence to run, to train a horse like that, to run in a graded stake. I mean, certainly if you have cheap climbers and some of these horses at these lower level tracks, they don't do much training, they don't gallop much, they don't breeze much, but to run in a grade two off of essentially 30 days of ponying in one work, it's just and be successful at it. That was really the thing. It wasn't just that he did different things. He was successful at it. And, sometimes I wish I had been around back in the 60s and 70s and when they trained horses so much different than they do, especially now, where they train them much, much harder. And I'm not even talking like the 20s and the 30s where they, work them four times a week and run them. But he always said that if I trained horses now like I used to train people, they'd want to lock me up. They'd think I was nuts. He goes, and he said the horses just can't take it. They're not strong like they used to be.
Yeah, well, he was certainly a confident guy, a guy that came up with a plan. He said, just because. You have a plan doesn't mean it's the right plan.
Yeah, he used to say that. He goes, just because you got a plan doesn't mean it's the right one. Because everybody worries about, you're not following the plan. He goes, well, how do you know? You don't know it's the right one until after you run. Yeah, it used to be a pet peeve. It used to drive him crazy. Was when people would train a horse, say, off a layoff, 3, 4, 5 month layoff, and they would train a horse in a certain manner, and they'd run the horse. And then the horse would run good, and then they'd go back and train the horse the same way. He used to drive him crazy because he would say, well, the horse is in a different spot now. I mean, the horse hadn't run in 5 months, so you would train him differently than after they just run. Well, I don't see why they think, everyone thinks like there's some magical training potion. It's just not so. And things used to bother him. And he would never say anything to anyone about that. I mean, he would even think of approaching you and telling you, why are you doing this? He would say things to us, and it was kind of almost in confidence, and he rooted for everybody. I mean, it's crazy, but I remember one time there was one particular trainer who was not very friendly and wasn't all that well liked, and his horse got beat in the photo finish, and I was like, God, I feel bad for him. That horse is this and that, and I'm like, why do I feel bad for that guy? Oh, I don't know, you guys are always mean to that guy, but that guy might, maybe he had a tough childhood growing up. You made an excuse for the guy. I was like, well, I'm not rooting for that guy, Chief. I don't care. Well, that's your problem. he would literally root for everyone. It was, like I said, he just was a great guy. And he was tough now. I mean, he could, he, he could get on your case, and you'd feel the heat. Believe me, if you screw something up, he wasn't shy about telling you. But he always felt bad, and you know, he'd always kind of try to make it up to you somehow. But I mean, we could talk, like, literally talked about Phil in an hour. We could talk for hours and hours and hours. There's so many different stories about him. But it was I was very, very fortunate to have spent 6 years of my life working with, like, you never felt like you worked for him. You always felt like you worked with him. And he treated me like he was one of his kids. And, you know, I got chastised when I did bad, and I was, you know, once in a while you get a little praise once in a while when you did good. But I think one of the proudest moments I ever had was, I'd gotten contacted by Mr. Ramsey's people about, you know, maybe interviewing for the job, because Mr. Ramsey was looking to hire a private trainer. And I asked Alan, I said, you know, what do you think? You think I'm ready? And he said, you're ready. And when he said that, that was like, a blessing from the heavens. You know, it was like God himself had said, yes, you're ready. And when he said it, it just gave me the confidence, because I was, you know, you're always a little doubtful when you're going on your own. It's a little scary when, you're gonna leave the circuit you've been on and, you know, go to a new place and, you know, start from scratch. But he said, then he told me, he said, you're ready. And then he said, if it doesn't work out, you can always come back. So, you know, he looked out for me. And it's ironic that Dave Hicks, who was a steward in New York at the time, happened to pass recently. And it was funny when I went to talk to him about getting my trainer's license, because in Kentucky they were only giving the test like once a month, and it was going to be a little bit of an issue if I had gone directly to Kentucky. So I went to Mr. Hicks and asked him if I could get how I went about going and getting my trainer's license. And I said, I have an opportunity to train horses in Kentucky. And he said, well, does Alan know? I said, well, of course, you know, Alan knows. I said, well, you know, what about taking the test? I explained to him the test wasn't being available for a few weeks, and could I take the test? He said, son, how long have you worked for Mr. Jerkins? I said, Mr. Hicks, I worked for him for about 6 years. And he said, well, that's test enough for me. You don't need to take any tests. You bring me proof of workman's comp and tomorrow, and I will license you as a trainer. And I said, thank you very much. So I never actually took a test to become a trainer.
That's really cool. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So there might be some suit in New York, and I get ready to change my, you know, to tell me my license is no longer eligible, or, you know, I got to take my trainer. What do they take now in New York? You got to have continuing education.
Right, right.
So it's kind of funny. It's just, listen, you're a horse trainer, continuing education on a daily basis, man.
Well, we got to go to a break, Chuck. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is fantastic stuff here on Trainer Talk. See you in a few.
Nominate your yearlings now to the Fasig Tipton Summer Selected Yearling Sales. These sales are the top three yearling sales in North America by rate of return. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky, July 10th and 11th. The Saratoga sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 7th and 8th. And the New York Bred sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 12th and 13th. Selected sales, superior results. Nominate today at FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pin hooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. to breed the best, to race the best,
Super Saver Russell Meyer, what a finish in the class,
and to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
Now is the perfect time to own a Kentucky bred and race in Kentucky. Kentucky breds win 70% of the greatest stakes in North America, and it's obvious that Kentucky breds start with a clear advantage. But there's more. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start. Learn more at KentuckyBred.org.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
A leader is Star Contender, 3 3/4 and 111 flat. To the attack here, 3 wide Diamond Isle. In between horses, Diamond Bachelor far outside. Hammer's Terror is under the drive, all swinging wide for the drive. Up the inside, Air Bueno and Zavarian looks for room next. Wide open, Star Contender digging in. Air Bueno threads the needle up the rail, down the outside, Hammer's Terror. No place to go for Zavarian. Inside the final furlong, on the inside, Air Bueno has the lead. Air Bueno rides the rail to win. Terror second, Star Contender third, close for fourth, Grand Isle, or Zavarian in 140-3.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld with our special guest, trainer Chuck Simon. I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio on iTunes. And Air Bueno, that was kind of exciting. That was just last summer. Talk about him a minute.
Yeah, he had a good summer last year. He was a horse that a friend of mine had told me about, a friend named Ozzie Nunez, who's down in Chile. And he, we had imported him in October, I guess, of 2014. And you know, the South American horses need, you know, the 6 months of acclimation time, and we weren't in any hurry with him. And he was getting ready to run, and his last work, Eric Cancel hadn't started riding races in the U.S. yet. He had worked him for me here at Palm Meadows, and he'd worked terrible. I mean, just like terrible. And Eric came back. He said, "Chuck, there's something wrong with this horse. It's not like lameness, but there's just like he's like so sluggish." I mean, he went like 54 to a head for the half, and we got him back to the barn, and he started acting all erratic, almost like a heat stroke, but not exactly. And then he was acting neurological, you know, like it was a neurological thing. And what had happened was we wound up taking him to the clinic, and what had happened was he had internal bleeding, and he was bleeding, basically bleeding out. Had we not brought him to the clinic where they diagnosed it really quickly and got him stabilized, he would have definitely, you know, died of internal hemorrhage. But it took a couple months to recover from that, and then when he came back in the first summer we raced him, he would run a good race and he'd run a bad race, and he'd run a good race and we tried different blinkers, different distances, and nothing much really worked, and he kind of seemed like a bust until last year. Kid riding the Matt Rispoli said to me, "You know what's funny about this horse is I got more horse galloping out than I do in the race." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "The harder I pull him up, they're trying to pull him up, the faster he wants to go." So I said, "All right, well next time when we run him at the quarter pole, start trying to pull him up, like just really get into his mouth, like take a hold, really hard hold of him." So he does that, and the horse wins. And he just kind of, I guess, we needed to figure that he just wanted to run through the bit. And as soon as he figured out how to ride him, the horse got to be an ultra-consistent horse. He just always fired. He was always right there. And, he won that one stake, and there was a couple stakes where he kind of got unlucky in that someone got loose on the lead, and he had tactical speed, but he really didn't have enough speed to challenge a leader early in the race. So, he turned out to be a pretty nice horse, and I recently sold him. I sold him. Gary Contessa bought him, brought him to New York. This year, he came back, and he seemed like he's 8 years old now, and he looked like he lost a step. And the lady that I owned him in partnership with from Chile, she died. So we were going to wind up with a licensing issue. And I did really well with him, and I just thought maybe it was time to cash my chips in and let someone else, let someone else try him.
Yeah, he's a cool horse, and hopefully he gets the same kind of ride in New York that he was getting from Rispoli.
Rispoli rode that horse really well, and matter of fact, they weren't bad rides per se. A couple of rides this year, but they weren't exactly like he wanted to be ridden. And honestly, he got a similar ride when Gary ran him up in New York, where he wound up four wide in a five horse field, and that doesn't work out too well. But hopefully he does well for the new connections. But he's a tough, honest, sound horse too. He's a sound horse. So he's a nice. He's one of those horses you look in their record, they got a lot of first, seconds, and thirds. They don't always win, but they're always right there and made a pretty good amount of money. So he doesn't owe anybody anything.
Yeah, nice for the owners. A few years back, decades ago, John Gosden had a horse that used to run at Santa Anita, and Terry Lipham would ride him, and he'd win on him. He'd win two or three, and then they'd put him in a stakes race, and they'd get a fancier rider, and the horse would lose. And then Terry'd get back on him, and he'd win. And so it's past the statute of limitations now. I was sworn to secrecy by Lipham, but I said I got a hold of him one day. I said, "What's the deal with this horse? Why is it every time you ride him, he wins, and when they put pink eye on him or something, he gets beat?" And he goes, "This horse has a breathing problem, I think." And he said, "I've figured out exactly where to hold his neck so that he can get air." And he said, "That's why he runs so good for me, because he can breathe. And I know exactly how to hold his neck." And he goes, "The other guys don't know how to do that. And I don't tell them." So
it's funny. There's a lot of times, there's little quirks that guys do find. And some riders just fit certain horses better.
Yeah.
Definitely. It just is that way. And, sometimes you got horses that are kind of rocky going, and you put a fancier rider on, and they may not be all that willing to let him run. That's happened to me a couple times, where the owners, insisted on a top jockey, and I kind of tried to say, "Well, your horse doesn't have the greatest way of traveling, and if she doesn't warm up great, this other guy's hungry. He's going to let her run no matter what. But, the top guy, he might not like the way she warms up, and he's not going to come and work her." So, and people forget that they're not just numbers on a piece of paper, that they're people, on those horses. And, the people, like everything else, you have your own way of doing things. And if I was a top jockey and I was riding all top horses, and you put me on a horse that didn't go so great, well, I don't know that I would be, all that willing to put that 100% effort in if I thought maybe the horse was going a little funny. Not funny enough to scratch, but funny enough to protect. And it's people forget sometimes that, trainers and jockeys, we're not numbers on a piece of paper that sometimes they want us to be. They want to say, "Well, you did 23% off this, or you did this or that." Well, sometimes it's just the way it is. It's not always you can't always break it down to just sheer numbers.
Yeah.
The guy who is winning 22% might not be the best horse for your horse. The guy who winning 12% might be better simply because he's hungrier.
Yeah, that's true. You mentioned earlier about adjustments, and those are the kind of adjustments that trainers make sometimes that go unnoticed, because it's not flashy, but those are things that the average person doesn't know.
No, and sometimes, Drew, it's tough to – you don't want to publicize the fact. You know, and there was a guy when I first started off training in Kentucky. He was an older trainer, and we claimed some horses off him, and we did really good with all the horses. And to be honest, all we would do is we would put him on ulcer medication, which at the time was relatively new. We'd worm them, you know, a lot of times they needed their, you know, ankles or knees injected. And this trainer was an old school guy, and he didn't believe in all that stuff. And, you know, I kept claiming horses off him, and I kept moving him up, and the guy got mad at me, and I finally told him, at the time it was 2000. I said, we're 2000, man. You got to worm these horses every couple of months. You got to, you know, you got to put them on ulcer medications. You got to do, you know, give them the supplements. You got to, you know, have the veterinarian take care of the issues, because if you don't, I'm not picking on you, but, you know, we didn't do anything spectacularly different with these horses. You know, sometimes people say, oh, well, you know, the guy must be giving them drugs or this or that. Sometimes it's just you're taking care of the horse a little bit better than the other guy was, and the horses respond. And, you know, nowadays, I mean, every horse, or almost every horse, is on some sort of stomach medication, and you know, people weren't warming is you know, pretty mundane, and it's not like the old days where we had to give them those, you know, remember the tube worms we used to give them?
Yeah.
You know, knock them down for a couple of days, and you know, now we have whole different generations of wormers, and there's so many different things that we do now that we didn't do just even back then, 18 years ago, but you know, sometimes just doing things a little different with the horses. I mean, Scott Lake did great for a long time, claiming the horses that off guys that trained hard and just totally backed off and just jogged them and put them back in and was very, very successful for a while, kind of going the other way with horses.
Yeah, just lightening up on their training. I had a guy that I used to claim off of, and I won like three or four first-time claims off of that guy, to the point where he got mad at me and said I was making him look bad. And I said, listen, you take great care of your horses, and all I do is pony them for, you know, a week or two and run them, and they run like trained pigs. But I said, I won't claim off you anymore, and I didn't. I retired from claiming off of him. But I didn't want him to be upset. He's a very good trainer, very talented guy, and a nice man, you know. But yeah, you see those horses out there galloping fast 2 miles every day, you know, and you go, well, this horse could use a little rest.
True.
So anyway, well, in case you tuned in late, this is Jude Feld, and I'm visiting with trainer Chuck Simon on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Lots of things have happened in the last 4 years, including you becoming involved in a new venture. Tell us about Tropical Racing.
Tropical Racing is an idea that my friend Troy Levy and I came up with. Basically, Troy had trained horses at Yonkers. He was a trainer driver when I was working there as an assistant racing secretary. So we've kind of switched roles. But, you know, because Troy, he got tired of training and went into business. And obviously, I got tired of the front office and I went into training. But one of the things that we've tried to do over the last couple of years is talk to a wide variety of owners and see what people like and what they don't like about owning horses, what people like and don't like about partnerships. And it sounds simple, but what we've tried to do is to take the positives and you know, focus on those and try to take the negatives and mitigate those, and to try to make people enjoy their horse racing experience more. You know, there's a whole different, it's a just different approach. A lot of partnerships are very, very straightforward in that they have a horse, they syndicate a horse for X amount, for however many shares, and, you know, you pay your board or your rate, and, you know, based upon how much you own, and you know, there's a period of time you own the horse until you don't own the horse, until the horse is sold or gets claimed or whatever. And there are some deals now, you know, where there's a fractional ownership where hundreds of people, or, you know, 50 or so people own a horse. So you're owning like a minute part of the horse. But what we wanted to do is be flexible. and we wanted to have the ability to take advantage of situations when they came up. So what we wanted to accomplish was make people enjoy their experience. And part of that was we wanted to make people, even the smallest investor, feel like a VIP. And what we've done is when you invest in a tropical horse or a partnership, because we offer a partnership, our first partnership just recently went online. It's a four-horse partnership. We're offering 5% shares in the four horses. But we also do, you know, individual syndications on horses, and we have another third section, which I'll talk about a little later. But we offer a whole variety of incentives and perks. We've teamed with Gulfstream to offer various percentages off of the bill, say at 10 palms. We have 15% off. If you're a tropical member, the cigar shop, you have percentage 15-20% off of a box of cigars. We have $5 valet parking any day. So if you come in, it's $20. If you're with tropical, it's $5, and you get a free program. And we have a whole and a host of perks that you receive if you are a member with us. And those, the list is growing. We have some hotels that have given us rates. We have restaurants, and the list is getting bigger and bigger. And we're working with the Chamber of Commerce to try to develop some strategic business partners with local businesses, because the truth of the matter is that people that own horses, the demographic is really a good demographic for a lot of businesses, and it's kind of an unknown to them, and people don't follow horse racing, don't realize that there's people with money and they're willing to spend it, and they're going to be in this area. They're going to be at the Gulfstream Park, Hallandale, Hollywood, Aventura area, and they're not just coming to the track, but they're going to go to a restaurant, they're going to go to a store, they're going to visit other places. So what we're trying to do is make this a kind of a community-based thing where we're not just selling you a piece of a horse. We're giving you other ways that you can, you can benefit. We use the luxury. We have used the luxury suites on race days. We just had a big party, Kentucky Derby viewing party, on Saturday, and it was very well intended. Close to 200 people up in the luxury suites, and everyone had a great time. The illegal alcohol I snuck in got confiscated, but other than that, it went off pretty well. But we also have a third option, and that's for people who simply don't have the money to write a $5,500 check and $600 or $700 or $800 worth of bills a month. And it's basically patterned after a membership club, a true membership club where you join and you get you pay a fee and you pay a monthly, which is $49 a month, and you have a huge list of businesses that are going to give you discounts, and you're going to get perks at these places. You're going to get priority seating at a restaurant, or a special rate or percentage off of all these different things. And what those people are doing, they're not actual owners of the horse, but they're buying into tropical racing as part of the team. And there's a lot of people that can afford $500 as a buy-in, and they can afford $40 a month. And this allows them to kind of be involved without having to, having the wherewithal to be involved. And certainly our major investors have a lot, more opportunity, and their perk package is a lot larger. But, we want to try to include as many people as we can. And, if people are engaged, if they feel like they're part of a horse or a stable, they're more apt to bring friends. They're more apt to bring family. They're more apt to talk about it on social media. And that's what racing needs. We need people to have good experiences. And we need people to spread the word, because the best The best advertising is grassroots advertising or word of mouth. And I think that we lack that. And a lot of partnerships aren't on the up and up, and a lot of them are. And a lot of the big ones have been hugely successful and have done a tremendous job bringing people into the game. But some of them haven't been so great, and I think that's something we want to do. We want people to feel comfortable. And for our first package, for instance, we have a four-horse package of two fillies, two colt, or two geldings, excuse me. They're two two-year-olds, two three-year-olds, kind of a diverse group. And we get the horses and train them a little bit before we offer them, because I want people to have be confident that when I say, I think this horse is worth this amount of money, that I'm not just throwing it out there and I'm not just trying to make the money off them. If I bought a bad horse, I'm going to stick them with that. That's not going to happen. If we buy a horse, I don't like the horse, we won't syndicate him. We'll race him ourselves if we have to. And, you know, especially with the two-year-old in trainings, it's you know, sometimes they're not always what they seem, and you look them at the sale ground and you get them home, and then a month later you're not so enamored with them. And, you know, that's one of the things that we will do is we will identify horses that we don't feel comfortable syndicating or putting in a package, and we will keep them ourselves. And especially, you know, starting out, I want everyone to have a good experience, and I want people to realize that, you know, there are, you know, honest people in the business, and you know, we keep 10% of every horse at the very least. We don't syndicate anything 100%, so we will stay in, and it's just, you know, so far the response has been very, very good.
Yeah, it's a very unique concept.
Very marketing.
Yeah. If somebody wants to get a hold, we've only got a couple minutes left. If somebody wants to get a hold of you or Tropical Racing, how do they do that?
Well, you can go to the website. Matter of fact, the website kind of explains things a little better than I explained them. And some of the numbers are written down so that you know, you can see them. It's a little easier when you see them in front of you than when I say, well, you know, this is how much it's going to be, this is how much it's going to be. But you can call myself or Troy Levy at 561-513-8767. You can go to tropicalracing.com, and there's a contact us page. You could go. We have a Facebook page. We have a Twitter account, and you know, we're very, very open. You know, about everything. You can come to the barn as much as you want. If you want to come every day, I might put a shank in your hand. But you know, we're not buying $500,000 horses. We're trying to buy horses that will improve, will be better. You know, the $30,000 range is kind of where this market down here in South Florida really tends to favor outside of the winter. You don't need $100,000 horses to compete here. It doesn't make sense.
All right. Well, we gotta go. We're running out of time here, Chuck. But thanks for taking the time to hang out with us. It was great as usual. We'll send you some gifts courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips, and we'll certainly look forward to Tropical Horses running as soon as possible. This is Jude Feld, and we're here at Jimmy John's of Lexington Studios. Good night, everybody.